I've titled today's faith message, Could We Welcome a Trans God? Unitarian Universalists typically don't do God talk, many of us rejecting the God of our upbringing. For many of us, just talking about God is uncomfortable. Yet images of God or gods impact our lifelong perceptions, whether we are believers or non-believers. To shake things up today, I will be reading commentary entitled God is Trans, written by Reverend Gretchen Haley in her blog of July 17, 2023, so it's pretty current. Reverend Haley is the senior minister at Foothills UU in Fort Collins, Colorado. And she writes, Before images of God, I had white Jesus hung in a picture frame in my childhood home. You can see his perfectly groomed beard and goatee, his long hair with soft curls, and his brown eyes that follow you wherever you go, which is both creepy and comforting. Now, alternatively, I had Jesus on the cross. Jesus is thin, wearing a crown of thorns, nails in his feet and his hands. And it never occurred to me that statues of a public execution from 2,000 years ago would be inappropriate to hang amongst other home decor. Because we were Catholic, I also had white Mary. Not in my home, at least not that I remember, at least not outside of Christmas time, but at church and Catholic school, Mary was everywhere, with her head down and covered in light blues and whites, or in the all-white statue at church where we'd place a crown of flowers on her head every May Day. Her eyes looked up at the sky in longing and devotion. Now, Mary was Mother of God. She was not herself God. She was worthy of prayer and adoration, but mostly as a way to try to appeal to God himself. Now, Jesus, on the other hand, had no such distinction. Jesus was God, which meant God was bearded, brown-eyed, with long hair. Every December, God was a newborn baby. The rest of the year, he was a late 20s looking shepherd that wore a white robe. At the same time, God was also God the Father, which sometimes made sense and sometimes didn't. He was very old, still with a beard, still white. Year round and all day, for all my growing up years, God was most of all a man, and his pronouns were obviously he and him. Even if it was also true that he was a man who also dressed in robes and walked around in those robes. It's difficult to articulate just how deep this original imagery runs in me even now. The way it still infiltrates how I live in the world, how I live in this body. First and inescapably in the ways it can lead to my default assumptions that men are right and good, no matter the evidence there may be to the contrary in a given scenario. I still catch myself in these assumptions. It's embarrassing to acknowledge, and annoying, and much worse than annoying. My first go at atheism was mostly an early feminist attempt to shake loose of that God the Father image, and my image of God is male. My first appreciation of the UU church basically came down to how infrequently they talked about Jesus or God. After all, as Mary Daly said 50 years ago, quote, if God is male, male is God. All of this is worse than annoying because it also connects to pain, real and steady, cultural and persistent pain And also shame that no matter how many versions of atheism I've attempted, I can't fully exercise that image unless I am actively tending to other images of God. I know this one will show up in my subconscious, ready to remind me that there will always be something in me that falls short, and God will always be the other. It's why I know our God talk must be more than absence or rejection. Our God talk must be constant expansion, curiosity, creativity, and growth. The dominant images of God being male and white is not just a problem for those of us who are not male or not white, by the way. There are other points of pain for those who are both, which in its most problematic expression looks something like what we see in the angry, lonely, terrifying, and terrified world of the manosphere. The manosphere is that mostly white, mostly straight male online space filled with bloggers, influencers, and online forums dedicated to misogyny and the idea that white men are the ones who are actually oppressed. Which you might believe if you have been told your whole life that your very nature is the same as God's. I'm confident that Mary Daly would not be sympathetic with the manosphere. In her 1973 Beyond God the Father, Daly described how, quote, the biblical and popular images of God as a great patriarch in heaven, rewarding and punishing according to his mysterious and seemingly arbitrary will, has dominated the imagination of millions over thousands of years. She describes life-destroying consequences of this default image of God, as she writes, quote, the divine patriarch castrates women as long as he is allowed to live on in the human imagination, unquote. Daly was not one to mince words. She always said she knew she'd be punished for being an itty-bitty feminist, so she might as well go all the way. The same year that Daly published Beyond God the Father, Unitarian minister and theologian Bill Jones asked parallel questions in his book, Is God a White Racist? Except instead of gender, Jones described the destructive consequences across history and culture of having imaged God as white. The way we imagine God always has huge consequences. Even if we are atheists, the God we don't believe in is still impacting us in reaction and often subconsciously. Not to mention, we all live in the United States in 2023, where according to a recent Stanford University study, the majority of Americans still believe and conceive of God as white and male, especially Americans who themselves are white and male. Which in turn the study also shows leads them to believe that people who are white and male will make better leaders, better bosses, better decisions, and do better jobs. Whether we believe in God or not, we all live with the emotional, social, and legal fallout of how God is imagined and languaged. It's one of the reasons I've always been an advocate for atheists becoming the most fluent in God talk. To think of God talk as the ultimate humanist project. Because despite the sometimes needy portrayals of God in the Hebrew Bible, God talk is not actually for God, whatever God is. God doesn't need our God talk. God talk is for, and I'd even say, about humans. Because ultimately, our images of God reflect what we believe about humanity, about ourselves. And our images of God determine what we believe about humanity and ourselves. Our images of God are reflections and determinants of how we see ourselves. So whatever limits we place on God, we place on ourselves. And whatever expanse we allow in our images of God, we make possible within our own human experience. The way we imagine God determines our sense of who is worthy of love and who is not. Who is worthy of power and who is not. Who is worthy of life and who is not. The way we imagine God communicates what we believe to be the ultimate aim, our ultimate aim, and the most supreme expression of good, which in the negative also means that as we imagine God, we define and describe what we most despise, the least desirable, the most unwanted. In many ways, this is what William Ellery Channing was after in his 1828 sermon, Likeness to God. It was the early 19th century in New England, and Calvinism was all the rage. Calvin was that theologian who described humans as irredeemingly worthless worms, and who declared that goodness was in God and God only. But by God's grace, some humans were saved, which has nothing to do with human effort or human choice. So Channing, from his pulpit in 1828, was like, "That is ridiculous!" Except it took 8,500 words. Channing asked, quote, "Whence do we derive our knowledge of the attributes and perfections which constitute the Supreme Being?" And then he answered, "We derive them from our own souls," unquote. What we know about God, we know because of what we know in ourselves, which means we cannot describe God as good without it being a reflection of the goodness in ourselves. If we claim God to be good, Channing asserted, then we must also affirm ourselves as good. Though Channing's preaching led to the official start of what became Universalism, we weren't Unitarian Universalists yet at that time, he was not the first in our tradition to critique traditional theological claims. Unitarian Universalists have consistently rejected these life-demeaning images of God and sought to instead articulate a vision of God that would offer what the Gospel of John describes as the point of everything, abundant life for all. Abundant life for all is a vision of joy and beauty and human flourishing, not for men or even for women, not for white or black, not for straight or gay, young or old, rich or poor, for citizens or immigrants. Abundant life for all is a vision of joy and beauty and human flourishing that extends beyond any of these binaries, beyond all borders, beyond any of our limited and limiting beliefs. It's a vision of universal love. With this same aim in view, in that our image of God both reflects and determines how we see ourselves, I offer for your consideration that, as Reverend B.K. Hipsher has said when we imagine God, quote, "What we really need is a trans God." We need an image of God that transgresses all of our human-conceived binaries, borders, and limiting beliefs. And then keeps going. We need an image of God that transcends all language and any words we might attempt to speak from our lips. Let us imagine a God that transcends our lips and our skin and our bones and our blood. A God that transcends bodies entirely, limited, aging, and aching as they are. Let us imagine a God that transgresses every idea we have about our bodies. Every concept of what is beautiful or sexy or desired or outcast. Let us imagine a God that transgresses every qualified concept of how we gender these bodies. Every way we've come to control and call out these bodies. Every judgment that rises and falls with empires and religions and election cycles. As Hipsher writes, quote, "We need a trans God that transgresses all our ideas about who and what God can be. One that transports us to new possibilities for how God can incarnate in the multiplicity of human embodiments. One that transfigures our mental images from limitations. One that transforms our ideas about our fellow humans and ourselves. One that transcends all we know or think we know about God and humanity as the Imago Dei," unquote. Now, Imago Dei literally means the image of God, but as a theological term, it describes a special truth about humans, which is the relationship between God and humanity. Imago Dei is the theological idea at the root of Channing's likeness of God, and it is the root idea of any claim I'm making in this sermon. Imago Dei originates in the book of Genesis when it says that God created humans in God's image. The term has come to mean that there is something in human nature that reflects God's nature, something in us that mirrors divinity in some unique way. The biblical text that grounds Imago Dei, the first chapter of Genesis, verses 26 and 27, uses the Hebrew word Elohim for God, which is a plural word. And Elohim said, "Let us make humanity in our image after our likeness." It is one of the many times the word Elohim is used. Other times the word Adonai or El, which are both singular nouns. The use of Elohim, scholars agree, is never an attempt to describe multiple gods, because one of the key distinguishing features of the Hebrew religion is monotheism. Instead, Elohim was used as a grammatical indication of multiplicity within a single being. I lift this up because I want to be clear that God's pronouns at various points in the Hebrew Bible, including the definitive text meant to underscore the reflection of the divine in humanity, are arguably they and them. We need a trans God, but let's also be clear that in seeking a God that transcends and transgresses and transforms our bodies and our lives, we do not mean to stop searching for an image of God that we can see in our bodies and in our lives. As Reverend M. Jade Kaiser says, what we need is to hear about God with all the different pronouns. Sometimes they and them, sometimes he and she, and even ze and zem, unquote. Because remember, imagining God cannot be a project only of absence and rejection. We do not need a trans God that transcends and transgresses all of our gender categories. We literally need a trans God. Alongside our images of God that is male and a God that is female, we also need images of God who is transgender, non-binary, genderqueer. We need to imagine God as one who knows the experience of being assigned one gender and who longs to be seen in their deeper truth and fuller expression. We need to imagine God as one who refuses to be pinned down, a God who defies our propensity to polarize, transcends all divisions, perpetually surprises us, and reinvents themselves. We need to imagine God who is queer, complex, confusing, even troubling, sometimes on purpose. All of these images, in turn, help us to expand how we imagine gender, this always sacred and strange concept we play with and struggle with and are still dying over. When God is trans, we understand that within the trans experience and the trans body lives a likeness to God. When God is trans, we know that trans lives are also divine. Every day in this country, our images of God are reflecting and determining the exact opposite message. Every day in our country, the prevailing images of God have trans and non-binary and queer people begging to be recognized. In response, let our trans God reach out their arms as they cup each person's face in their hands and say, as in the poem, Jesus at the Gay Bar by Jay Hume, "My beautiful child, there is nothing in this heart of yours that ever needs to be healed." Thus concludes the commentary by Reverend Haley. But the question remains, could we welcome a trans God here? Could you welcome a trans God in your heart? Let it be so.